Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world. Happy Monday, everybody. Today is February 9th, 2026. I hope you all had a wonderful weekend. And this morning, we have got a lot of news coming out of Asia. That seems to be where all the top news is this morning, starting with China. China has directed their banks to limit their exposure to U.S. treasuries, both in the form of reducing their purchases of U.S. treasuries as well as unwinding existing positions. Now, they're saying this is the part of the ongoing debate over the safe haven status of U.S. treasuries, something we've talked about recently on this channel about how U.S. treasuries weren't really functioning as a safe haven asset the way they should during certain market events over the last couple of months. But the cover story being provided, according to these unnamed individuals, of course, we don't name our sources anymore. This is all people familiar with the matter. Once again, they're talking about they want to diversify their risk, that this is not any geopolitical maneuvering, that this isn't about worries of the creditworthiness of the United States, which is kind of laughable because we all know default is inevitable for the United States, either via inflation or outright default. One thing or the other is going to happen. Look, Chinese banks hold about $298 billion worth of U.S. treasuries. The Chinese government has about $683 billion of U.S. treasuries, at least out in the open. There's a few hundred billion dollars hiding in Belgium as well. But here's what's not mentioned in any of these articles that are discussing this today. Nobody's talking about the freezing of Russian assets following the invasion of Ukraine, and nobody is talking about the seemingly inevitable Chinese invasion of Taiwan. And in that context, this move makes perfect sense. If you're the Chinese and your banks and your country respectively hold close to a trillion, maybe even more than $1 trillion worth of U.S. treasuries, and you saw how they took the Russian U.S. treasuries and seized them, froze them, in some cases gave them to Ukraine, are you going to stay in those assets before you invade Taiwan, knowing those assets are almost certainly going to get frozen by the U.S. and you're going to get kicked out of the SWIFT system? Of course not. You're going to unwind those things. And you can't just up and sell them one day. You'll crash the market, lighting your own money on fire. So you have to slowly begin unwinding these things. So I'm really surprised none of these articles covering this morning are even mentioning that this makes perfect sense from a military standpoint. And yet there it is. I really believe this has more to do with the pending invasion of Taiwan than any risk of de-dollarization or the new BRICS currencies or part of the trade war. No, this is about making sure their assets don't get frozen. Now, we've also got an article from S&P Global this morning talking about how they expect the real estate crisis in China to get even worse in 2026. That's interesting because they've been calling a bottom in Chinese real estate like monthly since, I don't know, 2021, since I started this channel. They've been very eager to call that bottom in Chinese housing, and it hasn't materialized. Look, they're saying now in 2026, home sales in China could fall by 10 to 14%. That is after initial estimates of 5 to 8%, obviously weren't enough. Things just keep getting worse in the Chinese housing market. Meanwhile, slightly across the pond there in Japan, still in Asia, we've got Sunaitake Ichi won by a landslide yesterday in the snap elections in Japan. Now, you may recall Sunaitake Ichi, the first female prime minister in Japan. She's a member of the Liberal Democratic Party there. She came into power, and right away she started talking about stimmies and she started talking about defense spending. She became particularly aggressive towards China and Taiwan, saying that Japan would intervene on behalf of Taiwan if the Chinese invaded, something the Chinese threw a freaking hissy fit about. Takeuchi wants to change the constitution to remove some of the institutionalized pacifism that was put in after World War II. And she wants to get the stimmies flowing. She wants to spend big on her military. And over the weekend, she got the mandate to do that. The Liberal Democratic Party won by a huge margin yesterday in Japan. And so we've got Japanese stocks are going to all-time highs, ripping higher here because the stimmies are coming. Their bonds are falling because it's going to be all borrowed money. And you can expect a lot more spending from Japan. And interestingly enough, we're watching the yen strengthen a bit this morning. And that strengthening of the yen is because the Japanese government's probably going to borrow so many of them that they're going to become scarce, Let's see what the central bank does in Japan. Japan has had this experiment with modern monetary theory that's been going on for the last 10, 15 years or so. They talked about getting rid of it, and now it looks like they're just jumping headfirst right back into it. Meanwhile, be on the lookout later this week for big-time jobs revisions. We're supposed to get the annual benchmark revisions to U.S. payrolls. It's expected on Wednesday. It's a little bit delayed. We didn't get the non-farm payrolls last week because of the short government shutdown. If you remember this time last year, there was a massive downward revision to most of the 2024 numbers. 911,000 previously reported job gains all went up in smoke in March of last year. Well, that's coming out later this week, that same data point. And they're saying it could be even worse. And we're still waiting on the jobs report from last Friday that we didn't get because of the shutdown. All indications are that the labor market is continuing to weaken. And that is very significant here, guys, especially because of, I want to point out some of the work of Mike Green. Michael Green at Prof Plum on Twitter has been doing fantastic work about passive flows and about why employment is so important. We've watched the unemployment rate slowly tick up. We've watched the job market weaken to the point where it's kind of like the housing market. It's just frozen. Nobody's leaving their job. Nobody's getting a new one, just like the housing market. Nobody's buying or selling a house because we all kind of know the houses aren't really worth what we're claiming they're worth. Kind of like we all know the job market isn't that strong. So everybody's clinging to the job that they have. Well, what happens if we get a spike in unemployment? What happens if people start losing their jobs? Well, we've seen what happens. They start tapping into their 401k. And we've been watching hardship withdrawals rise for several years now. So what happens if enough people lose their jobs where the passive outflows from the market of people living off of their retirement savings starts to overwhelm the people buying into the market through their paychecks and their 401k programs? Well, we've never seen that. This whole grand experiment in passive investing, it's not really that old. It didn't really hit its stride until after the GFC. So, well, I guess we have that to look forward to as well. We've got Google is issuing bonds to pay for their data centers. Their first seven-part tranche, or tranche one of seven, is being issued today. Google joins the ranks of Meta and Amazon, who have totally exhausted their free cash flow from their immensely profitable businesses, and now they're tapping into the bond market even more in order to pay for this game of CapEx chicken, the biggest waste of capital in human history. Well, we've got that going on as well this morning. We've got Novo Nordisk is suing Hims and Hers over their knockoff Wegovy drug. Cuba can't fuel their planes because of threats of tariffs and fuel embargoes, especially since the U.S. grabbed Maduro in the middle of the night and that Venezuelan oil stopped flowing into Cuba. Cleveland Cliffs earnings came out. That's interesting. Cleveland Cliffs is down a little bit on their earnings after being up big for most of the last year. That's a steel maker. And that's interesting because the steel tariffs, right? Steel is the one industry that was like, bullseye, we're going to help the U.S. steel industry with the tariffs. And, well, it's just further proof that the benefits from the tariffs will take a lot longer to get here than the pain of the tariffs, something we've known all along, and we've talked about this. You can see it in those Cleveland Cliffs earnings. And last but not least, stick around to the end of the show. You got to look at this article about this Thoma Bravo loan. And this was going around late last week, this story broke, but it's really wild because all the rage last week was the sell-off in software stocks, right? Everybody's like, oh, software is dead because Anthropic is so great and some Gen Z guy with no training is going to vibe code software as a service and put Microsoft and Salesforce and everybody completely out of business with their vibe coding. And so nobody wanted to touch software stocks. And yet Thoma Bravo is borrowing $1.2 billion to buy a software company called VTech. And the provisions in this loan are some of the weakest provisions I've ever seen. It's almost like the people that are lending them money don't care because it's not really their money. Wait till you see the garbage debt that is being taken out to buy this software company, which is supposed to be toxic. Why? Because it's your retirement money. That is what private credit and private equity are doing. They are raiding your 401k. Stick around to the end of the show. You're going to want to see that one. In the meantime, why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the YouTube algorithm for you new guys so you can come back tomorrow and have your coffee with the Melonheads, because we do this every single day. Right now, the S&P 500 is negative for the morning, down 18 points, about a quarter of 1% lower. The Dow is also down this morning, off by 92 points or 0.18% after breaking 50,000 last week. You know, despite all the selling that was going on in tech last week, the Dow actually had a really good week. There's a lot of rotation into some of these consumer staple names, the safer dividend payers, and out of the risky dog shit tech. That was noteworthy last week. Meanwhile, the NASDAQ is off by 96 points or 0.38% lower. The selling in tech is resuming this morning, but it's much more muted than we saw last week. The U.S. dollar is a little bit weaker this morning, off by 66 basis points at 96.97. This is being primarily driven by Japan and by the strengthening of the yen this morning off of Sanae Takaichi's election victory. We'll show you that USD JPY chart in a little bit. Meanwhile, looking over at the bond market, you know, despite all these headlines about Chinese dumping U.S. debt and de-dollarization, the U.S. bond market does not seem to care this morning. The yields are a little bit higher on the long end, but just barely. The 30-year yield, 4.873, up by only 1.8 point, not even 2-point move in the 30-year. The 10-year's at 4.212, higher by not even 1 point. The 2-year yield is lower by almost a point, to 3.487. And the 1 month is at 3.691, off by a fraction of a point. The bond market does not care about this China story, at least not yet. Looking over at the commodities board, metals are quiet this morning. Oh, there, I jinxed it. I said they were quiet, me and my big mouth. Right now, we've got spot gold 5,015, back above that 5K mark, looking good. They're up 54 bucks or 1.1% higher. April COMEX futures are at 5,037, up by about $58 or 1.1% higher as well. Spot silver is kind of quiet this morning, 79.84. We were as high as 82.46 overnight, but currently up about $1.78 or 2.25% higher. March COMEX futures are at 79.45. That's higher by $2.50 or 3.3% higher. I like to see the smaller move in metals here. I like the shiny. Copper's a little bit higher here, 0.25%. Platinum is down by 0.8%. Palladium is off by 1.6%. And crude oil is lower by 0.6%. 63.18 for March WTI futures. No news out of Iran over the last couple of days. A lot of people were expecting some fireworks in the Middle East this weekend that did not materialize. Looking over at Bitcoin this morning, looks like the selling is resuming, albeit at a slower pace than we saw last week. Currently priced at $68,516 on Coinbase. That's lower by about $1,700. So Bitcoin didn't do a lot. The big selling happened middle of last week, Tuesday and Wednesday in particular. We had some pretty severe selling. But back under that 70,000 level. Keep an eye on Bitcoin here and check out this story out of South Korea. This is pretty wild what happened here. Korea probes crypto exchange over $40 billion in ghost Bitcoin. What is a ghost Bitcoin? Well, that's Bitcoin that this Korean exchange fat-fingered into existence out of nowhere and then real quick tried to undo it. South Korea is investigating how cryptocurrency exchange Bitthumb initiated an exchange of $40 billion in Bitcoin that it apparently didn't have. Regulators have formed a task force to investigate industry-wide practices after the Seoul-based exchange on February 6th started crediting accounts with a small fortune rather than the 2,000 won, or about $1.37 per person, authorized for a promotional campaign. The incident stemmed from an employee inputting the payout as Bitcoin rather than won, according to a statement from the Financial Services Commission. The Financial Supervisory Service said Monday that it was looking into the incident and had initiated on-site inspections with a formal investigation to be initiated if legal violations are found. It was nothing more than erroneously entered virtual data, yet it ended up being traded, said FSS Governor Lee Chan-jin at a press conference on Monday. That is the essence of the issue. The transaction was actually executed. In the 20 minutes it took to recognize the mistake, 620,000 ghost Bitcoin, or about $40 billion, rather than 620,000 won, or $423, appeared across the balances of hundreds of customer accounts, according to BitThumb. Let's put that in perspective real quick, guys. MicroStrategy owns somewhere around 720,000 Bitcoin. So this Korean exchange accidentally created 620,000 Bitcoin out of thin air. Now, I know a lot of people are going to be like, see, Bitcoin can be created just like fiat. This wasn't actual Bitcoin created. This was an IOU Bitcoin created on the exchange. The actual supply of Bitcoin didn't change in circulation. But what happened is this crypto exchange issued IOUs for 620,000 Bitcoin in the blink of an eye. That's a very big deal because that's enough to wipe out this exchange. Some customers immediately tried to sell their serendipitous crypto, resulting in the sale of 1,788 Bitcoin. None of the tokens appeared to leave BitThumb, according to the exchange, but payouts were made. It had recovered 93% of the value of those sales by Saturday in either WAN or other tokens, BitThumb said in a statement. The company reconciled the remaining outstanding Bitcoin using its own assets, it said in a statement on Sunday. So that's a big deal, guys. $40 billion, and they only recovered 97% of it times 0.97. So that means the exchange is on the hook for $1.2 billion of their own assets to pay for the Bitcoin that they created out of thin air that was somehow sold and taken off the platform. This was a huge mistake. This is another reason why it's important to not leave your crypto on an exchange, to not leave your Bitcoin on an exchange. When you hold Bitcoin on an exchange, what you really own is an IOU Bitcoin. You don't actually own a Bitcoin until you pull it off of the exchange and put it into your own wallet that you possess. In which case, I mean, this exchange just created $40 billion out of thin air. Keep an eye on this one. I don't know how big BitThumb is and what their assets and reserves are, but something tells me they're not going to easily absorb this $1.2 billion. We'll see what comes out of that story. Meanwhile, here's the big one this morning. China urges banks to curb exposure to U.S. treasuries. This one was breaking overnight. Chinese regulators have advised financial institutions to rein in their holdings of U.S. treasuries, citing concerns over concentration risks and market volatility, according to people familiar with the matter. Officials urged banks to limit purchases of U.S. government bonds and instructed those with high exposure to pare down their positions. The people said, asking not to be identified, discussing private deliberations. The directive doesn't apply to China's state holdings of U.S. treasuries. Communicated verbally to some of the nation's biggest banks in recent weeks, the guidance reflects growing wariness among officials that large holdings of U.S. government debt may expose banks to sharp swings, the people said. The worries echo those made by governments and fund managers elsewhere amid brewing debate over the safe haven status of U.S. debt and the appeal of the U.S. dollar. Chinese banks held about $298 billion worth of dollar-denominated bonds as of September, according to data from the State Administration of Foreign Exchange. It's unclear how much of those were treasuries. Probably most of it is U.S. treasuries. Let's scroll down a little bit here. This is nothing new, although the banks is a new angle. The Chinese government has been doing this for a while, but this is the first time we've heard about their banks doing it. China's overall state and private sector holdings of U.S. treasuries have consistently declined over the past decade. Once the world's largest creditor to the U.S., China was overtaken by Japan in 2019 and by the U.K. last year. The Asian nation's stockpile has almost halved since the peak in 2013, dropping to $683 billion in November, the lowest since 2008. Some analysts say the actual decline may be smaller, as Beijing may have shifted some of its holdings to custodian accounts in Europe. Belgium, whose holdings include Chinese custodial accounts, according to market analysts, has seen its treasury holdings quadruple since the end of 2017 to $481 billion. So that last paragraph is meant to show how, for some reason, the Chinese are somewhat hiding their ownership of U.S. treasuries by using these custodial accounts in Belgium. And Belgium is now like third or fourth on the list of largest holders of U.S. treasuries in the world, because most of those are being held on behalf of the Chinese. But besides all that, the Chinese have gone from about $1.3 trillion in U.S. treasuries all the way down to $683 billion. Now they're telling their banks to unwind it. And again, they're talking about de-risking and dollar volatility and safe haven status. And look, there's perfectly legitimate macroeconomic data to support all those arguments. But in my opinion, the simplest explanation of this is they want to be out of U.S. treasuries as much as possible when the missiles start flowing over the Taiwan Strait, because they know the U.S. is going to do exactly what they did to the Russians, and they're going to freeze the assets and seize those reserves. And so they want to sell them before that happens. But you can't just sell it all at once. They'd be lighting their own money on fire. So they are going to continue this gradual unwind as much as they can. And everything I have read has said 2027 is the year that things pop off. I hope I'm wrong about that, but it seems like more and more pieces every day are being moved into position for that. Meanwhile, S&P is already predicting China's property slump will be worse than it expected this year. It's just February, and they're already saying it's going to be worse than that. S&P Global Ratings has lowered its forecast for China's property sales this year, barely 2 months into 2026. The firm said Sunday that preliminary real estate sales will likely drop by 10 to 14% this year, worse than the 5 to 8% decline for 2026 sales predicted back in October. This is a downturn so entrenched that only the government has capacity to absorb the excess inventory, the analyst said in a note. They added that the state could buy more unsold property to create affordable housing, but so far these efforts have been piecemeal. China's property market, once accounted for more than a quarter of the economy, has seen its annual sales volume cut in half in just 4 years. Beijing's crackdown on developers' high reliance on debt for growth sparked the initial slump, while consumer demand for homes has yet to pick up. Economists have long warned of overbuilding in China's property market, but developers have only kept up construction despite the sales slump, leading to a sixth straight year of completed unsold new housing, according to the ratings agency. And that's been my gripe all along. The Chinese have been trying to come up with all these cockamamie schemes to figure out a way to complete construction on buildings that they had already sold because they didn't want to default on their pre-sales. But when you complete all that construction, you add to an existing supply glut, thus making the problem worse, further driving prices lower. And that's exactly what's happened. China's property slump has progressively worsened throughout 2025. In May, S&P predicted a 3% decline in sales of new homes, only to revise that number in October to an 8% drop. But sales ended up falling by 12.6% to 8.4 trillion yuan, or $1.2 trillion, less than half the annual sales of 18.2 trillion yuan seen in 2021. Now, that's just the 2025 numbers, and they're saying those are now going to fall by 10 to 14%. And if this trend continues, these estimates keep getting worse and worse with each iteration, so they may fall even more than that. No bottom in sight for the Chinese housing market. Oh, and by the way, I have to notice this. Total sidebar here. Look, scroll up from the headline, and what do we get on this CNBC site? Oh, where did it go? Oh, they got rid of it. It was a CoreWeave ad. Here, let's show it up here. Look at this. Why is CoreWeave advertising on CNBC? For all those retail investors' data center needs, or are they maybe advertising their stock? That's interesting. CoreWeave spending money on ads. Okay. All right. Now back to your regularly scheduled programming. Here's the story coming out of Japan this morning. Takaichi triumphs with Japan's biggest post-war election victory. That means the fire hose of stimulus shall be opened up here. Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi secured a historic election triumph, positioning her as the nation's strongest leader in the post-war era in an outcome that sent stock prices and bond yields soaring. Her ruling Liberal Democratic Party achieved the biggest post-war victory for a single party in a general election in Japan, an extraordinary transformation of fortunes for a party that was on the ropes last summer before getting behind the nation's first ever female premier in October. The LDP secured a two-thirds supermajority in the 465-seat lower house by itself, according to public broadcaster NHK. A tally of results by NHK early Monday showed that the ruling coalition had won 352 seats in the lower house, expanding its previous razor-thin majority of 233 by a considerable margin. The LDP's haul of 316 seats gives it a higher proportion of representatives in the lower house than any other party in post-war Japan. And you can see here a huge defeat for the opposition here, the Centrist Reform Alliance. Takaichi had staked her job on the outcome of the snap election just months after taking office, saying she would step down if her ruling coalition failed to win a majority. The gamble appears to have paid off spectacularly just 7 months after the LDP lost control of both houses of parliament. Takaichi's mandate to push ahead with bold spending plans gave fresh life to the so-called Takaichi trade, underpinning stocks while weighing on bonds. I don't get why they're saying, oh, it's a bold spending plan. You're wasting money. You're spending more money than you have. That's not bold. That's incredibly reckless. All right. This Keynesians write these articles at Bloomberg. So I guess this looks bold. Fortune favors the bold, Matt Damon. Nikkei's 225 index rallied as much as 5.7%, the most since April, while yields on the benchmark 10-year bond jumped to 2.275%. Remember, yields rising, that's bond prices falling, because everybody knows Takeuchi is going to borrow money they don't have, spend it into the economy, driving stocks higher, but stress liquidity in the bond market in the process. The yen fluctuated, weakening initially before pairing losses to trade around 157 to the dollar as of 9:30 a.m. in Tokyo. A supermajority in the lower house will make it even easier for her coalition to pass legislation and put the contentious issue of a constitutional amendment back on the table, reviving a debate that has energized nationalists and spooked advocates of Japan's longstanding pacifism. And that is all about increasing spending in defense, about building those missile bases in the Senkaku Islands to defend Taiwan. Recall earlier this year, there was this big geopolitical rift. The Chinese threw a fit because Takeuchi said Japan would come to Taiwan's aid if the Chinese invaded. It's almost like maybe it's a bad idea to start World War III in the first place, but that's all right. We'll talk about that later. Well, it looks like Takeuchi got the mandate she was looking for, so that is coming here. And right now, the Japanese yen is strengthening considerably against the dollar. These are daily candles on the USD-JPY chart. You see here, we got a big move down, undoing some of the gains last week. And remember, this chart moving lower, that means it takes fewer yen to make $1. So that is the yen strengthening. It looks like the yen is strengthening because Takeuchi is going to borrow all of them to spend them into the economy, which means there may not be enough yen to go around. So the yen gets more valuable. That is until the Bank of Japan decides to support that spending by monetizing the debt, printing more yen into existence as they've done for the last 15 years or so. And be on the lookout for job revisions later this week. Next U.S. jobs report will define just how much the labor market is slowing down. A denser than usual jobs report is expected to show just how much the U.S. labor market has slowed in recent years, or perhaps that it wasn't growing at all. And I don't know what a dense jobs report is, but that's what the wording they're using this morning. In addition to the usual monthly payrolls and unemployment data in the January jobs report due Wednesday, it also includes highly anticipated revisions to payrolls. Those are expected to substantially mark down the pace of hiring after a preliminary estimate suggested a record downward adjustment of 911,000 in the year through March of 2025. Now, that was the benchmark revisions last year in March, and a lot of people made a big deal out of that, and rightly so. 911,000 of those previously reported strong job markets. Remember Jay Powell talking about how strong the labor market was and that their dual mandate was in balance and everything? Yeah, well, that ended up all being fake. Well, we get another one of those. And if it follows the pattern of the last few years, the government inflates the jobs gain so that they can celebrate the headline. Then a month later, they quietly downward revise them a little bit. And then at the end of the year, one big massive downward revision that wipes out almost all of those job gains. We're getting that later this week. The annual benchmark revisions are going to be more consequential than normal this year, said Scott Anderson, chief economist at BMO Capital Markets. Right now, the labor market does appear to be on a knife's edge between net job growth and maybe job loss. With the release of each January employment report, BLS benchmark payrolls to a more accurate but less timely series called the Quarterly Census of Employment and Wages. That data is based on state unemployment insurance tax records and covers most U.S. jobs. So look, it's probably going to be a downward revision. We don't know how big. Probably going to be pretty big. Last year, it was almost a million. They're saying it could be even bigger than that. And remember, the head of the BLS got fired late July last year that they fired the head of the BLS. And one of the reasons was that big 911,000 downward revision to the jobs markets combined with a big downward revision. It was like over a quarter million to the June and July numbers. So we get more of that this week. How bad will it be? I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. Meanwhile, Google is borrowing more money to build data centers. Google parent Alphabet kicks off seven-part U.S. bond sale. All right, so they're issuing seven tranches. This story just broke this morning. Very little details here, but what we do know is that the first tranche of this debt is going to be about $15 billion, which, assuming the other six tranches are the same size, that would be about $105 billion that Google intends to borrow all to build out data centers. Remember, we found out that Amazon was going to issue debt and equity last week in order to build out data centers. Meta is already in bed with Blue Owl Capital using special purpose vehicles and off-balance sheet debt in order to build data centers. This capital incineration continues here, and the market punished big tech for this last week. Every company that announced big increases in their CapEx saw their stocks sell off last week. It's almost like they won't get the message. They can't get the message. They refuse to accept that their shareholders don't want this crap, but they're still spending it. And by the way, it looks like they're getting pretty favorable terms here. Initial price discussions for the longest portion of the deal, a 40-year bond, are for a premium of about 1.2 percentage points above U.S. Treasuries. These things are essentially riskless. They're getting this money almost for free. So Google spending big on data centers still. Meanwhile, we've got Novo Nordisk sues Hims and Hers over cheaper copycat versions of Wegovy pill and injections. This story broke last week. I typically don't like covering the pharmaceutical industry because there's just such a bunch of degenerates and they create drug addicts. And Hims and Hers is one of the worst offenders in this category. But this is making front page news here, and the stocks are down big on this. So we're going to cover it this morning. Novo Nordisk on Monday said it's suing online telehealth provider Hims and Hers for mass marketing cheaper, unapproved copies of the drug maker's new Wegovy obesity pills and injections in the U.S. Novo is asking the court to permanently ban Hims from selling compounded versions of its drug that infringe on the company's patents and is seeking to recover damages. In a release, Novo accused Hims of deceiving patients and putting their health at risk as the safety, efficacy, and quality of those copies are not verified by U.S. regulators. The move escalates the feud between Novo and Hims, which said on Saturday it will stop offering the new obesity pill, copycat, after facing scrutiny from federal regulators and legal threats from the Danish drug maker. Hims had planned to offer the oral drug for as little as $49 for the first month, roughly $100 less than Novo's approved Wegovy pill. Novo's Copenhagen listed shares were up 7%, while Hims was down 19% in pre-market trading here. Now, this is kind of important because Hims already said we're going to stop. The FDA threw a fit over this last week. So Hims says on, I think it was Thursday or Friday, they said, okay, we're going to cancel our plans. Now Novo is suing them anyway. They want to punish them for even thinking about this. And well, Hims and Her Health is getting destroyed this morning, down 26.25% on this news. Now you can see here late last week, this was the pop the stock got when they announced this pill. And then, of course, you know, Novo threw a fit and it started to go down and the FDA got involved and the stock sold off even lower than it was. Then along comes this lawsuit and the stock is just getting demolished this morning, $16.90 for Hims and Hers Health. Meanwhile, Cuba says international airlines can no longer refuel there as Trump turns up the pressure. Ever since Venezuela, ever since they grabbed Maduro in the middle of the night, Cuba has had a hard time putting gas in the tank, and it looks like it's getting pretty bad here. The Cuban government said international airlines can no longer refuel there due to fuel shortages after President Trump threatened tariffs on any country that supplies the communist country with oil. The nation's leadership said Sunday that Cuba will run out of aviation fuel on Monday, likely disrupting airlines operating there, citing two sources. The kerosene shortage is expected to persist for the next month, with all of Cuba's international airports affected. The Trump administration has sought to tighten U.S. chokehold on Cuba since January 3rd when it conducted an audacious military operation to depose Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, a longtime ally of Cuba's government. In an executive order issued at the end of January, Trump said the Cuban government constituted an unusual and extraordinary threat, which required a national emergency declaration. Gripped by deepening energy crises, Cuba on Friday outlined extensive measures designed to protect essential services and ration fuel supplies for key sectors. The plan reportedly includes restrictions on fuel sales, the closure of some tourist establishments, shortening school days, and a reduction of the work week in state-owned companies to 4 days from Monday through Thursday. So the fuel shortage is taking a big bite out of Cuba. Oh, look, there's the CoreWeave ads again. Why is CoreWeave advertising? Probably to sell their stock. But I digress. Things in Cuba, things, the fallout from this Venezuelan seizure of Maduro continuing this morning. And, you know, tariffs played a big role in that Cuba story, and tariffs plays a big role in this one as well. Cleveland Cliff stock drops on earnings miss, but 2026 should be better. Look, we're getting kind of late in the show here, and we're running a little short on time. The point is here, Cleveland Cliffs is a big steel maker. Their earnings were okay. The stock has had a really good run, but it wasn't great. And steel is one sector that the tariffs have deliberately targeted U.S. steelmaking to try to strengthen U.S. steelmaking by putting big tariffs on steel made in other countries. And this article just goes to show you, you know, the earnings were okay, but not great. It goes to show you that it's going to take a long time for any of the benefits of tariffs to materialize. You don't reverse 50 years of outsourcing with one executive order overnight. It just doesn't work that way. Now, Cleveland Cliffs stock, ooh, taking a beating this morning. It was only down 1% or 2%. Now it's down 21%. What the hell happened to Cleveland Cliffs? They must have said something on their conference call. That is a bludgeoning. Wow, they went from down 2% to down 20% with the opening bell. I don't know what happened there. Other than the earnings miss, it didn't seem like it was that big. I mean, they're even saying here in the headlines it caused the stock to drop by 3.4%. You might want to revise that headline there a little bit. Yikes for Cleveland Cliffs. Tariffs not enough to help this one this morning. Although remember, over the last year, the stock is still up 15.1%. Although it was up 30 or so percent earlier this morning before that sell-off. Man, big sell-off in Cleveland Cliffs. All right, last one of the day. And we got to talk about this one because, again, I've been warning about private credit and private equity and all this garbage debt. Now, everybody knows what happened in software last week, right? Nobody wants to touch software. It's toxic. AI is going to kill all the software companies. So keep that in the back of your mind as you look at all of the clauses that were attached to this debt to buy a software company. Thoma Bravo inserts lender anti-rebellion clause in buyout loan. Thoma Bravo just raised the stakes in the tussle between private equity firms and their lenders by deploying a loan provision to help smoke out creditor rebellions before they even begin. The firm added the clause in documents tied to a $1.2 billion loan it got from private credit lenders to back the acquisition of cloud-based software provider VTech by its portfolio company Majesco. That's according to people familiar with the matter. The provision requires that lenders alert Thoma Bravo within 3 business days of any attempts they make to coordinate with other creditors in so-called cooperation agreements, the documents viewed by Bloomberg show. Those who fail to notify the firm of such pacts will forfeit voting rights they typically have on matters like amending credit agreement terms or covenant waivers, according to the documents. So what this, first of all, they're borrowing $1.2 billion to buy a software provider. Okay, this is like supposedly a dog shit company. But they're putting an anti-rebellion clause in here. The creditors, if they don't like what Thoma Bravo's doing, if they're starting to worry about the quality of this debt, they're not allowed to go talk to the other people who own this loan about, hey, do you want to take them to court? Do you want to try to trigger some kind of covenants here, recover our money? They have to notify Thoma Bravo within 3 days if they do that. Why would they agree to that? I have no idea why anybody would agree to that, but they did. But that's not all they agreed to. The loan was offered at just 4.5 points above the benchmark rate, low by market standards. So they're getting very little interest for this, with the option to reduce it to 4.25 percentage points based on progress curbing leverage, so the interest rate could go even lower. The deal is also covenant light. Cove light, that's the favorite of private equity and private credit, which means more flexibility for the borrower. It also offers an option for payment in kind or PIK on the loan, meaning the borrower can pay its interest with more debt rather than cash. The facility is also non-amortizing, which means the borrower doesn't have to make payments toward the principal balance, just interest, and pays it back with a lump sum at the end of the term. So they don't have to pay the principal down. They only have to pay interest. That interest can be paid with payment in kind, which is just more debt. The interest rate's going to go down over time. There's no covenants attached, nothing about like minimum liquidity requirements that might trigger default clauses. All of that's out there. And there's this anti-rebellion clause in there. Who in their right mind would agree to all this crap to buy a software company in a week where software was selling off like crazy? If you answered nobody, you're paying attention. You're right. Nobody would ever pay this. Nobody would ever agree to this unless it's not their money that they're lending. And that's the rub, because it's not their money that they're lending. It's your money. It's your 401k, it's your IRA, and it's your pension. The ones that are buying these dog shit loans are retirement plans, thanks to President Trump's executive order on alternative assets. Just look at the garbage that they're doing on a software company in a week where software is selling off like crazy. You can't make this stuff up. Private credit, guys. Be careful. Know what's in your 401k. They are coming for your retirements. And I just want to say thank you very much to Armando. What's going on, Armando? He says, Celente once predicted $130 a barrel. We saw Venezuelan seizures. Iran is seizing. And now there are reports of Russian oil being seized. Yeah, Europe is getting much more aggressive with the Russian shadow fleet tankers. I saw that one over the last few weeks. The Venezuelan seizures. That oil is still flowing. It's just flowing to where we want it to go, not where we don't want it to go. That's an interesting caveat there. And Iran, that's a work in progress. We don't really know what's going on with Iran. The Iranians did seize, they seized two tankers in the Gulf last week. They attacked a third, or they were harassing a third, whatever wording you want to use. Look, I think these things are all related. I think the seizure of Maduro in Venezuela and the oil there, the Russian shadow fleet tankers, the seizing of Iran's oil, or, you know, the pressure they're putting on the Iranian regime to try to tap into the anger in these protests to topple the Ayatollah's regime, has been a thorn in our side since the 1970s. The Cuba sanctions, the shortage of fuel, their inability to fill their jetliners there, and the U.S. treasuries, the Chinese banks unloading U.S. treasuries. These are all small pieces on the chessboard of geopolitics that are all being prepositioned for this conflict over the Taiwan Strait. I hope I'm wrong about that, but it really looks like everybody is just setting up for their attack. And, you know, the UK and the Europeans grabbing the Russians, that maybe doesn't have as much to do with Taiwan and China as it does Russia and Ukraine. But I view the two conflicts as part of a larger conflict, to be honest with you. So would oil hit 130 a barrel in that scenario? I don't know, Armando, because right now the oil market is oversupplied. It's oversupplied with a boatload of geopolitical risk hanging like a sword of Damocles over its head. I don't think we see 130 anytime soon, not without a closure of the Strait of Hormuz, which could happen, but it hasn't happened yet. Thank you, sir, for supporting the channel. Armando's back again, says, I've seen two trucking companies go under so far for this new year. Keep an eye out for more. That is a bad sign. We did see some trucking companies go out of business. I suspect the crackdown on the CDL mills may be playing a role in that. Craig Fuller from Freight Waves came on the channel a couple months ago and talked about how, you know, these non-domiciled CDLs that just like anyone and their brother could sign up and in a half hour training end up with a commercial driver's license, and they're wreaking havoc on the roads. The government is cracking down on those CDLs, leading to a shortage of drivers that could be driving some trucking companies under. That being said, while all that is happening, Freight Waves has also been highlighting how freight rates have been rising substantially over the last couple of weeks and months. In particular, they really put the pedal to the metal, no pun intended, last week. It is a very good time for trucking, believe it or not. Because of the crackdown on capacity, the few that are still operating can name their price. And so it's actually a really good time to be a trucker, even as the trucking companies that are overly exposed to these non-domiciled CDLs might be going under. A lot of them also took out a lot of debt that they couldn't service in 2021, 2022, during the truck driver shortage. They overextended themselves, and then we hit the freight recession after that, and they couldn't service their debt. So that's also contributing to some of these companies going under. That being said, it's actually a pretty good time for freight. And that ISM services, not services, the ISM manufacturing PMI that came out last week also showed a big surge of new orders to start 2026. That caught a lot of people off guard. That is a good omen for the trucking industry as well, because all those new orders are going to turn into shipments eventually. Thank you again, Armando, for supporting the channel, sir. Appreciate that very much. Steve Woodis, what's going on, brother? He says, Ari, Financial Times story on February 1st. Xi Jinping declares China's ambition for a global reserve currency. Good luck with that, Xi. Backing the renminbi with gold. Thoughts? Well, if they want to back their currency with gold, it's going to be really hard for them to print renminbi in order to loan them out for their Belt and Road Initiative projects. It's going to be hard for them to print renminbi to build missiles to invade Taiwan. It's going to be hard for them to print renminbi to bail out their housing sector. When you back your currency with gold, you give away your power to loot the public wealth via inflation. And I call me a skeptic, Steve. Forget what Xi says he's going to do. I have never in my life experienced a communist dictatorship willingly give up power without a gun to their head. And they don't have a gun to their head right now. I just don't think they'll do it because they need the ability to loot the public via inflation to pay for all the things they want to do. I wish we would back our currency with gold, but we won't do it either for the same reasons. If we're going to build ships and if we're going to build missiles and if we're going to rebuild manufacturing in the U.S., they're going to do it all with printed money. So I'd love to see the world decide this experiment in fiat currency and money printing is over. It went the same way all other historical experiments with money printing went. I'd love to see that. I'm very skeptical that it would ever happen. Thank you very much, Steve, for supporting the channel, sir. And thank you, everybody, for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button on the way out, should you feel so inclined. Thank you guys for the super chats, as well as you magnanimous Melonheads on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me a Coffee. Links down below, should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.